Hi, my name is Mira Patasin. I'm an author and I'm an activist, and GoFundMe is my go-to platform for fundraising. The first GoFundMe I did was to raise money for a chapbook or a collection of poetry and essays and short stories. So we started a GoFundMe and our goal was $7,000. What I've learned is so special about GoFundMe is that it's a whole collection of people offering anything from like $4 to $400. And each time you get a ping that someone donated, even if it is just $4, it's so exciting. So if you have a goal and you get there, you can keep making it bigger and bigger and bigger. We did go past our goal. It was amazing.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Those who are suicide bombers or members of a terrorist organization like Hamas tend to get more money because the organization wants to reward them and their families and show that they take care of their own.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Shai Davidi.
Before we begin, I'd like to thank our Patreon members for their unwavering support. And part of the perks that they receive for that is watching the recording live. My guest today is a managing partner at OSIN LLC, which is a litigation firm specializing in, among other things, in terror financing. Here I am with Gary OSIN.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming in. I must say, I believe you're the first lawyer that we have in the show. But I've been traveling around the country and I've been telling a lot of people, partially in jest, but partially real, we don't need less Jewish lawyers, we need more Jewish lawyers. And hopefully today people will understand a little bit why. But before we do, I want to start by asking you, Gary, what kind of a Jew are you?
I believe there's only really one kind. We are very different and very varied in our backgrounds and religious practices, but I learned from a very early age in my experience with my father, who was forced to emigrate from Germany in 1937, that regardless of how we see ourselves, most of the world sees us as indistinguishable and, frankly, not even as separate people, but as a group. And so as much as we are proud of our different heritages and traditions, whether coming from the Middle East or places like Yemen or Ethiopia or coming from the Pale of Settlement in Europe, at the end of the day, we're all one.
We're all one. And how did you, what was your path to becoming a lawyer?
Well, my father was a lawyer, and pretty much ever since I was about 3 years old, everyone said, oh my God, he's going to be a lawyer.
Were you an argumentative child?
Not so much argumentative, but I like to share my thoughts and opinions from a very early age. And it was only later in life that I realized that that sentiment was not always complimentary when they said he's going to be a lawyer. But I've always had an interest in the legal process and in the political process in the United States and in international affairs. So sort of my career arc has largely tracked my interests.
So I want to get to the many of the important cases that you have litigated, which I believe tell almost the story of a lot of what we're experiencing and seeing now. But before I do, I want to ask you about a case you litigated years ago. I think it was called the Hans Sachs? Hans Sachs poster case.
Yes.
What was that case? What was the story there?
So Hans Sachs was a German Jew who really invented the entire concept of collecting posters and treating posters as an art form. separate and apart, of course, from painting or sculpture. He really recognized, going back to the late 1890s, that commercial poster art really was art. Up until then, it was really thought of as just disposable. And he started to collect, and he founded a magazine in Germany for enthusiasts who shared his view. And for many years, he ran that magazine, and he became the world's foremost collector of posters and poster art. And of course, that collection eventually came to the attention of the Nazi regime, specifically Joseph Goebbels. And there was an effort to acquire this extensive collection. And that effort largely consisted of arresting him and sending him to the Oranienburg concentration camp, which persuaded him that he should allow for the donation of his collection to the Ministry of Propaganda. Hans Sachs was fortunate enough to emigrate from Germany, came to the United States, and rebuilt his life, but of course without his poster collection, which was really his first love. And for most of the remainder of his life, he was under the impression that it had been destroyed in the war and that it no longer existed. And he wrote letters, and he tried to do outreach to the East German authorities, because many of your viewers may be too young to remember that East and West Germany were divided throughout the Cold War. So he was really writing to the communist authorities in the former DDR, as it was called. And he went to his grave thinking that his collection had largely been destroyed in the war. And it turned out, in fact, that the vast majority of it had been preserved, had not been destroyed due to the bomb damage or other war activity, and had been archived in an East Berlin museum. And this came to light because the museum, after the end of the Cold War, put out a catalog and put out notice that they were going to show some posters and so forth. And of course, these were the parts of the collection. So
this was stolen Jewish art.
Yes. Subsequently nationalized by the East German communists. And then it resided in a, I'd say German museum, because after the reunification, East Germany ceased to exist. So it was all sitting there in a German museum, and the family, specifically Hans Sachs's son, Peter, contacted me and asked that we take on this case. And the normal procedure at that time was to write to the museum and explain who the parties were and, ask them to return it.
Wait, one second. When you say normal procedure, how many cases, approximately were like these, where Jewish collectors lost their art to the Nazi regime, which then became nationalized under East Germany?
I don't know if it's ever been quantified, but there are certainly hundreds of such cases. Some of them, of course, very famous. There's a movie that was made about the Klimt painting, The Woman of Gold, or I think that's the title, Woman in Gold. There are many such cases, and the vast majority of them unsuccessful for various reasons, because the sort of general view with artwork is that, especially when you're dealing with artwork that's changed hands many times since 1940 or 1945, that the bona fide purchaser, the person who bought it, let's say 1975, doesn't know it's stolen, paid full value for it, and they shouldn't be deprived of their rights just because there's an unknown prior issue of ownership. So many of the museums and private collectors have fought any kind of restitution of this artwork to the families. And this was no different. The museum didn't want to turn over the collection. And my client went in front of the special commission that had been set up in Germany to hear such cases. And incredibly, the German commission concluded that Hans Sachs loved his posters so much, he would have preferred them to be in the hands of the successors of the those who stole it from him, rather, because he was a German patriot and so forth, and that it was best left in Germany in the hands of the museum. Well, we had to go to court in Germany, and to make a long story short, it was ultimately resolved by the German High Court, their Supreme Court, in returning the property to him. So he passed away shortly afterwards, but he did get the benefit of actually seeing much of his father's collection and being able to hang a few of them, of the posters that he liked most and remembered from his childhood, in his own home. So, you know, we count small victories in life.
When you approach a case like that, and I know this might seem like a false dichotomy, do you approach it more as a lawyer or more as a Jewish person trying to preserve part of our history?
In general, I have to say I view it really from a perspective of a legal case and of justice. I certainly am cognizant, having worked for, you know, 20 years on Nazi-era cases, and certainly many of my clients, as we'll discuss in, for example, October 7th cases, are Jewish. But I've never really thought of it as principally a Jewish undertaking, or one that's specific to Jews or the Jewish people. I represent and have over the years American service members killed in Iraq, Christian missionaries who were kidnapped and murdered in Colombia. So I'm not at all ignorant of the obviously unique Jewish element of Holocaust cases, or the significance to the entire Jewish people of the October 7th attacks and so forth. But I really focus on the facts and evidence of each case, the merits, and a sense of trying to bring some extremely small measure of justice for people who have suffered in various ways and who have never received even a sense that there's justice in the world.
Right, and I think nothing shows that justice better than your cases against the state of Iran. We should say, for people watching and listening, we're recording this the day after Israel has struck an unprecedented attack on the IRGC's heads and of the nuclear facilities in Iran. So we don't know, once this episode comes out, what the state of the world will be, but we can talk about what it was and is until now. So what are those cases, the Carter versus Iran cases?
So from approximately 2006, I got a tip from someone that there was an enormous amount of money laundering going on with a particular bank in Europe on behalf of the Iranians, and that it was very bad. And they sent me some materials and so forth. And at the time, I was, as I always am, just neck high in other cases and other issues. And so I looked at it. It was very interesting. It was compelling. But I didn't act on it immediately. I just opened a file on that subject. And I started to look a little bit, sort of in my very limited spare time, at the Iranian activities, particularly in Iraq, because this was at the very sort of epicenter of the Iraq conflict with the U.S. dealing with the insurgency there and so forth. So it just sort of built over time, and I collected more material. And I can't speak to a specific sort of eureka moment, but it became clear to me over time that the Iranians were playing a direct and oversized role in the death and injury to U.S. service members in Iraq. Like most people who just follow the news in the ordinary course, I had heard, of course, about the insurgency. I'd heard about Al-Qaeda in Iraq and the various atrocities they were committing. But I never really thought of it as principally an Iranian operation. I thought of it as sort of a byproduct of the post-war occupation, of the fight between various sectarian groups. But I never thought of it as a signature IRGC operation against the United States and the coalition. But the more I looked into it and the more I went through public statements that the American military was putting out and so forth, I realized that much of what we were seeing, I was, and the public at large was misunderstanding the events as they were transpiring. And so,
what does that mean for if we wanted to break that down for someone like myself, an uninformed observer watching the news? Is this Iranian soldiers? Is it what exactly was Iran's role in the Iraq war and the insurgency?
It's a great question, and I'll change tact a little bit by saying it's not just Iraq, but it's Hezbollah in Lebanon. We now know, and it's been acknowledged by the Iranians and Hezbollah, that in 2003, right after the U.S.-led invasion, Iran dispatched, with obviously consent and coordination with Hezbollah, they dispatched two of their most senior terror operatives, Imad Munia and his brother-in-law, Mr. Badreddin. The two of them went to Basra in 2003 to begin to set up a Hezbollah-like clone proxy organization and to start to cultivate the various groups, that Shia groups that were aligned with and came from the same sort of DNA as Hezbollah. One thing that I learned studying this over the years is that the Shia seminaries in Najaf were the breeding ground of both the Lebanese and the Iraqi Shia militia leadership. And this was a common thread. They went to school together, essentially. And in our terms, they would have been college buddies. Mm-hmm. And so that provided the natural link because, again, for your audience, the Iranians are Persians. They speak Farsi, not Arabic. They are culturally quite different, even from their Shia co-religionists, same branch of Islam, but the Iraqis are Arabs. And so in many ways, Hezbollah, who are Lebanese Shia, but Arab Lebanese Shia, are culturally closer and have greater cultural affinity to the Iraqi Shia. So to bridge the gap that the Farsi-speaking Persian Shia Iranian regime needed to bridge with their proxies in Iraq, they used Hezbollah as the go-between. And so they started to work on building up their local proxy militias. And then they brought in some of the proxies they had been developing since the days of the Iran-Iraq war, who were originally Iraqi Shia, fled Saddam Hussein, stayed in Iran, and then were sent back in large numbers to organize the militias and terror cells. And these cells, bringing it back to your question about Karcher, these cells were organized. The U.S. military ultimately called them special groups. They were professionalized terror cells funded and trained by the IRGC and given very specific weapon systems to kill and maim American and coalition forces in Iraq. And unlike al-Qaeda in Iraq, which also received some weapons and training and money and safe haven from Iran, but were not controlled by them, the Shia militias were under the direction of Hezbollah and the IRGC, and they were given a weapon which the Americans call an EFP, an explosively formed penetrator. It's a anti-tank or anti-armor weapon, unfortunately now deployed in places like Gaza from the same source. It's a weapon usually about this big. It's like a little oil drum with a copper cone at one end and then packed with explosives. And without attempting to explain the physics of it, when you pack high explosives with a copper cap, which has to be machine tooled to a certain angle and degree, so it's a weapons grade, it's not homemade, that because copper heats up at a certain temperature, when you launch the explosives through the container, the copper forms a soup can sized slug at high velocity that can penetrate any armor the U.S. military had or to this day still has. And so it became the weapon of choice to kill American soldiers in their Bradley fighting vehicles and their Humvees. And the number and success rate of these attacks was unprecedented. So it's one thing for al-Qaeda to hit a soft target like a mosque or a school or to blow up a building by parking a truck in an area that's not guarded by the U.S. military and so forth. That's certainly a horror and a tragedy, but less of a threat to the American service members in Iraq than an armored vehicle like a Bradley, which is basically a tank that can be destroyed and its occupants slaughtered by this one signature weapon.
And approximately how many Americans were murdered in this way?
There's no exact figure for it because it's only really at the end of 2005 that the U.S. military started to specifically quantify and identify these weapons as opposed to marking them as IEDs. Mm-hmm. After the invasion in 2003, for about 2 years, they didn't really have an understanding of what they were seeing. They set up something called Task Force Troy, which was a forensic unit of the explosive ordnance disposal teams, and they started to catalog them. And they started to send out site exploitation teams after an attack to see what kind of weapon was being deployed. And so we know that they, and this is, by the way, in the U.S. designation of the IRGC in 2019, it says there were over
designation six... Designation as a...
As a terrorist organization. The IRGC, the government said, killed at least 600 American service members. And the reason they can't quantify it even more precisely is because there are some attacks that predate the testing process. And even after Task Force Troy was created, not every site of an attack was safe to send forensics teams into. So we don't know for sure, but a ballpark estimate is that Iran and the IRGC, together with Hezbollah, killed about 700 troops and maimed, you know, thousands more.
Now, this might be a naive question, but I believe it's a question that it comes out in any lawsuit, which is a question of intent. why is the IRGC even getting involved in the Iraq insurgency, especially early in 2003 when it was just happening and starting?
Well, they saw it as an opportunity. Starting with the Iran-Iraq war, obviously Saddam Hussein and his nominally Sunni regime was fighting against nominally Shia Iran in this horrendous, hard-fought war that lasted for a long time. When Saddam Hussein was removed from the picture, there was a power vacuum, and the United States tried to fill it by holding elections and by supporting a democratically elected government. The problem was that, and this is a problem in the Middle East writ large, is that the majority of the Iraqi population is Shia. They had been oppressed for generations under Saddam and his predecessors. This was an opportunity for them to gain power. But how are they going to gain power? It's not like the United States, where a candidate like the mayor of Indiana, Pete Buttigieg, can like give a good speech, get some support, find himself in the polls heading into a primary. That's not the way the Middle East works, certainly not the way Iraq worked. So who's going to be the most organized? Who's going to get their political support? Who's going to show on the ground that they can get things done? Well, the people who have the most guns, the people who have the most support from the IRGC, who are able to control territory, deliver goods, steal things more effectively, and pay salaries to their employees and to their militia. So in many respects, the United States very naively superimposed American thought processes on how democratic government works, not realizing that, in the Middle East, the best case scenario is that political parties are like Tammany Hall in the 19th century in the United States. They're vehicles at best for patronage distribution for local communities, to reward your followers and punish those who are on the other side. But of course, with the benefit of weapons and longstanding cultural and religious disputes, it's largely a function of who has a greater capacity for violence.
So you take on this case. Your plaintiffs are about 1,000 U.S. service members.
Right. It always or almost invariably starts with a few families and a specific case, and then kind of builds from there as it goes. So really the first case, or the first one that really drew our attention, was an attack that took place in Karbala in Iraq in 2007, where Hezbollah planned the attack on a police compound where U.S. service members were present, and it was a highly complex attack. They had American vehicles, uniforms that they were able to either steal or replicate that looked like Iraqi police, and they were able to penetrate this police compound and kidnap and ultimately murder 5 American service members. And it was that attack that really jumped off the page, because the organizer of the attack was an individual named Dakduk, who was Lebanese Hezbollah. Here's a Lebanese Hezbollah commander in Iraq in 2007 planning and organizing this very elaborate attack. And I think that was sort of the springboard for all the others, because it shows that these are interconnected networks. They're not random events.
So how do you prove the link? I assume at some points there's, someone gets caught live and through interrogation and questioning tells some of the story, but in court, how do you link the specific kidnapping and murdering of five servicemen all the way to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps.
So as it happens in that case, there was a raid conducted jointly by the British Special Operations Service, Special Air Service, rather, and U.S. Special Forces in Basra, and they captured both Dakhduk himself and Qais Ghazali, who was the head of the Iraqi Shia group, Asaib al-Haq, which was the that contributed the personnel for the operation. And they were detained. Dakhduk at first pretended to be mute and stalled his interrogation for a long time. But in the end, all of the people that they rounded up gave extensive interviews on multiple occasions. And of course, the U.S. military also acquired their laptops and the contents of the safe house that they were in. So there's a tremendous amount of documentation and information on that particular attack. With respect to the many other attacks that I reference with these EFPs, there are forensic records kept by the U.S. military that we've had to work very hard to obtain through Freedom of Information Act that provide the forensics that show a particular IED attack in Iraq was in fact an EFP. And then there are experts, of course, who were in Iraq, who worked on these issues, some of whom were literally the wire cutters who deactivated bombs that were found and so forth, who have very specialized expertise and can tell you that even looking at a particular circuitry board, that this is a signature of Hezbollah, not done by other groups and so forth. And so there's a lot of science involved, there's forensics, and of course, experts who lived through that whole experience.
So you sue basically the Iranian government in U.S. courts. My understanding is they never show up. So what's the point? What's the goal of the lawsuits?
So there are two points. One is that when victims obtain a judgment from Iran, they are eligible to submit a claim to the U.S. Victims of State-Sponsored Terrorism Fund, which Congress set up and which basically authorizes the Treasury Department to take monies that they obtain from various settlements with companies, really, primarily, who've been caught evading U.S. sanctions against state sponsors of terrorism. Those civil and criminal forfeitures that are taken from various corporate actors who've been caught and have pled guilty or entered into a plea agreement, those fines, if you will, get placed into the victims' fund. And then every 2 years approximately, the U.S. VSST, as it's called, pays out a very small fraction of the judgments that the victims hold against Iran. So if a father of a soldier killed in Iraq is awarded $5 million by a court, the fund might pay them out $50,000 or $30,000, depending on how much is in the fund at a given time. And that happens every 2 years. So over time, particularly for service members and many other victims, while it's not, you know, life-changing in the sense that it's not like winning the lottery or anything like that, but in terms of like their day-to-day lives, you know, that kind of compensation can be quite meaningful for them.
So it's a way, it's more about restitution rather than deterrence. It's not that the Iranian government is saying, well, now you've sued me, I'm going to stop, you know, using my proxies against you.
No, but there are two other factors I would add. One is that, for example, before the Carter trial, it was very little understood that Iran was involved in targeting our soldiers in Iraq. And the trial and the findings of the court became quite instrumental in changing the public perception of the Iranian role in these. So when you hear on the news all the time, used to be like the charge against the Iranians was that they were responsible for the Marine barracks bombing in Lebanon, in Beirut in 1983, which they were. But this sort of updated the story. It showed that in 2009, 2011, they're actively killing American troops. So that was important. And in fact, one of my clients in the Carter trial was eventually invited because of that trial to the State of the Union address in 2020 when President Trump spoke of the assassination or elimination of Qasem Soleimani, the head of the IRGC Quds Force. He pointed to my client in the gallery and her son to talk about, you know, the loss of Christopher Hake, who was one of the soldiers who was killed by Iranian proxies using Iranian weapons and so forth. So a lot of it is about making the record, establishing a legal and historical record that otherwise wouldn't come out. But there's one other point to add, which is that all of these judgments against Iran, today as we speak, Iran has bigger problems. But in the course of their efforts over the years to move money through the international system or to get relief from the United States, for example, when the U.S. previously essentially paid hostage ransom to Iran for the release of certain Americans held by the regime, one of their big concerns in getting money freed from a Qatari bank or what have you is that it's in U.S. dollars. It has to move through the financial system, and they know that there are all these judgments against them. So they have to work extra hard to find mechanisms to avoid enforcement proceedings against them. So while they don't show up in court, that doesn't stop us and others like us from going around the world and looking for Iranian assets against which we can enforce the judgments. So it's certainly far less effective at constraining the Iranians or deterring them than what is transpiring right now as we speak. But over the years, it's been an important factor in the Iranian consideration of how they move money and what levels of steps they have to take to protect their assets.
And since you've touched on that, I think another group of legislations or lawsuits that you've brought about is not necessarily against the state sponsors of terrorism, but about the banks that help launder. So, and I understand this is a little bit, this happens under the Anti-Terrorism Act. So what is the Anti-Terrorism Act and what exactly goes on in those pathways of the money going through, for example, allegedly HSBC and other Western banks?
Well, fortunately, we don't have to say allegedly because HSBC entered into a deferred prosecution agreement and admitted that they laundered money for the Iranians. But yes, this is the separate path from suing state sponsors of terrorism, which has to be done under an exception to sovereign immunity. Most states have sovereign immunity for political decisions or even for crimes they may commit as long as they're not done in the United States. That's the Sovereign Immunities Act, but you just mentioned the Anti-Terrorism Act, which was first enacted in 1992. It was sponsored by Senator Grassley, who amazingly is still in the U.S. Senate all these many years later. And that statute empowers American citizens and their families to sue individuals and companies who aid and abet or conspire with terrorist organizations to further terrorist acts. So that statute's been on the books since 1992. It's been rarely used before 9/11. Really, 9/11 was the first time it was really directed at corporate malfeasance. In that case, Saudi charities and banks and other related entities at first. And then there was a case brought by the family of David Boehm, a young man who was killed by Hamas in, I believe, 1996. And that case was brought in Chicago, and that was really against a variety of American charities, so-called charities, that they alleged were involved in financing Hamas, one of which, the Holy Land Foundation, was later convicted by a jury in Dallas for providing material support to Hamas. So those were really the first cases that were brought, but again, two or three in the course of 10 years before the, you know, since the statute. And we took that a little bit to the next level when we filed our case against Arab Bank on behalf of victims, American victims of the Second Intifada. And there we alleged that this bank, a Jordanian bank, which had the largest branch network in the Palestinian territories, was deeply involved in supporting Hamas and other terrorist organizations in the region. And
what does that involvement look like? I go into the bank. Well, now I do everything online, but I walk into a brick and mortar. You know, I deposit, I make withdrawals. What do terrorists do? How does that play about?
Somewhat the same way, but with a couple of differences. So in the case of Arab Bank, we alleged and ultimately proved that, to take one example, the founder and spiritual leader of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, had an account with them. Yassin was until 9/11 probably iconically the most recognizable terrorist in the Middle East. And yet they opened an account for him and they processed transfers for him. And that was true for another guy who's still unfortunately with us, Hamas spokesman Osama Hamdan. Osama Hamdan had an account in Beirut with the bank, and Hamas actually advertised not his name, but the account number for donations to the organization. And as a result, we were able to show a jury at trial that some of the donors, maybe the less intelligent ones, wanting to make sure that the money was going to go to Hamas and only having the bank number, you know, account number, would write on the memo line "for Hamas" to make sure that it was understood.
Wow.
So we were able to show the jury transactions that they processed that said "for Hamas" on them. And that's certainly one aspect of it. But the other aspect of it was the allegations, again, shown at trial in 2014, that Arab Bank worked hand in glove with an organization called the Saudi Committee for the Support of the Intifada al-Quds. It was a fundraising organization that sent money both to individuals and to Hamas institutions in Gaza and the West Bank. But what they were doing in large quantities were sending martyr payments and prisoner payments to individual beneficiaries.
Now, explain to our audience, what is a martyr payment and what is a prisoner payment?
Sure. So in the Palestinian territories, there is a longstanding infrastructure for paying the families of so-called martyrs, usually defined as people who've been killed in confrontation with Israel, which means they, of course, include suicide bombers and other terrorists who commit attacks, but it could also be terrorists who are just eliminated by the IDF, as well as bystanders, people who are caught in the crossfire. If they're killed by the IDF for one reason or another, they're automatically a martyr. And of course, those who are suicide bombers or members of a terrorist organization like Hamas tend to get more money because the organization wants to reward them and their families and show that they take care of their own. In addition, the Palestinian Authority and Hamas both, but the PA more notably, pays prisoners, security prisoners. So you don't get paid if you stole a car, but if you kill an Israeli or you murder a tourist or what have you, and you're serving a sentence, you get a payment from the Palestinian Authority. And the way the system has long worked in the PA context has been the longer your sentence, the more money you get. And so, of course,
and the longer your sentence means the more people you've killed.
Precisely. The worse the crime, as it were. So that's the PA. But the Saudis, in support of Hamas at the time, wanted to do more. And so they set up their own program to separately and in parallel track reward the families of the prisoners and the martyrs and so forth. And the process was that most of the beneficiaries were not account holders. They're just people, families of killers who lived in the particular neighborhood. So the logical way to do it from a logistics standpoint was to utilize Arab Bank because it had the largest branch network. So the most towns, the most coverage, if you will. And what we saw was that the families could go into a branch of the bank, present their ID, present their, you know, evidence that their child or their husband or whoever had been martyred. And then the bank would teller would check off the list, make confirm that they were on the authorized list, and then hand them, if it was a martyr or suicide bomber's family or whatever, they'd get $5,316.16, which is the conversion rate in dollars to Saudi rial. Or if they were a prisoner, they would get half that amount, $2,600 and so forth. So on those lists is like a who's who, of course, of Hamas bomb makers, suicide bombers, you name it. Wow.
Which brings us to October 7th and a lawsuit, which I think is very fascinating because it brings together all the previous lawsuits together. It's knowledge of terrorism. It is maybe financing of terrorism, but it happens by a U.S. citizen. So who is Bashar Masri?
So Bashar Masri is a member of a very august family, and really the closest to Palestinian royalty. It's a family from Nablus. His great uncle on one side is the chairman of Arab Bank, who we sued in the other case, who's one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest, Palestinian. And his other uncle is Munib Masri, who was a close confidant of Yasser Arafat and the proud owner of an Italian villa on a mountaintop in Nablus. So that's sort of the family background. He himself was sent to the United States for college and graduated from Virginia Tech and worked a little bit in the U.S. and then went back to the Middle East and sort of made his fortune. And after the Oslo Accords in 1993, he really got into the development game in the Palestinian territories, which meant leveraging, you know, international and U.S. institutions for seed money to develop various projects. And he's probably most famous for his Rawabi development outside of Ramallah, which is like a planned town, much more modern and so forth, and really was intended to be a showcase for Palestinian economic development. So that's his background. And he's always cast himself in the media and the press as sort of a a moderate force, a believer in focusing on economic development, working when necessary with the Israelis, not being impractical by, you know, boycotting Israeli businesses or what have you. If you're going to be successful in development, he argued, you really needed to have a working relationship with the Israelis. So,
sounds like a good guy.
Yeah. And, you know, in the Middle East, as you know, the spectrum of good and bad is probably different than it is in, you know, Peoria or somewhere in Middle America. So, you know, a lot of people have long thought that Mahmoud Abbas is a relatively good guy, again, on a spectrum. He's also the author of a dissertation denying the Holocaust. So, you know, you have to work with what you have and not what you wish for. But Masri certainly spoke and has presented himself to the world as a charming and sophisticated, westernized individual who, you know, believes in coexistence.
Why are you suing this guy?
So the flip side of that coin is that you sometimes see a version of this phenomenon, I think, in every culture, whether it's Italian-Americans or African-Americans or whatever, who sort of go outside of their original community, if they originally came from Little Italy or they came from Harlem or what have you, and wind up living, you know, a completely different life as a very successful entrepreneur or whatever, they like to come back to the old neighborhood and show that they're still part of the community, that they haven't forgotten their roots. And I think that's true in every community, pretty much. You could substitute any ethnic group for that. And so I think Masri, recognizing that he's seen by the Palestinian public as an American or as a high flyer, someone who's not in touch with the struggles of the average person, wanted to be seen as someone who still had street cred in the neighborhood. And one way to do that was to continue to support projects in Gaza, even after Hamas took over the Gaza Strip in 2007. And so part of showing that he could work with all sides meant working with Hamas as well as the PA and as well as the Israelis. And so his projects typically were pretty high profile. They included two hotels, the two best hotels really in the Gaza Strip, the Al-Mashtal Hotel and the Blue Beach Hotel, which are right across the street from one another on the Mediterranean. So those are sort of they're quite, you know, prestige locations, at least by Gaza standards. And then he was also running the Gaza Industrial Estate, which was established in 1997, 1998 with money from USAID to build this light industrial zone right on the Israeli border, right next to the Karni crossing. At the time was the major transit point between Israel and Gaza. The idea was to develop light industry. There's a Coca-Cola small bottling plant there. This was supposed to be the showcase for the post-Oslo viability of the Palestinian state. And again, for many years, that was fine. It had its ups and downs. But 2007, Hamas took over, and Masri and his companies didn't leave. They just started to do business with Hamas. Now, their rationale, I'm sure, is that they're trying to support economic development, that they don't want to abandon their workers and all that. But the bottom line is, you know, when you do business with a terrorist organization, one that has a long track record of murdering people and commuters and buses and and people in cafes, it's impossible to separate out, you know, your business from complicity with the terrorist organization.
But is it illegal to own a business in Gaza?
It's not illegal to own a business in Gaza, but it is illegal to give money or any other form of material support to Hamas or to any other designated foreign terrorist organization.
So if you own a business in Gaza, I assume you pay some taxes. So is that where the breach happens? Or?
Well, from a legal standpoint, yes. If you pay any money to Hamas, you're in violation of the criminal laws of the United States. Now, whether you're subject to U.S. jurisdiction for those crimes is a different question, because the money for U.S. jurisdiction, particularly in a civil matter, there has to be a nexus to the United States. But in principle, any money that goes to Hamas is a criminal violation. Here, the issue isn't that Masri simply kept the hotels open or didn't shut down. It's that Hamas decided to build an entire tunnel infrastructure, attack tunnel infrastructure, under the hotels, into the hotels, right? They were accessible from inside the hotels, and they were used to facilitate the terror infrastructure of Hamas, and we allege drew their power from the hotels themselves, because one thing that we learned studying this issue is that, contrary to my, I don't know, expectations about how tunnels work, my expertise was from watching movies like Shawshank Redemption or The Great Escape. You know, the POWs have a shovel and they try to tunnel their way out under the wire. That's basically my very primitive understanding of it. But when you are dealing with tunnels that are meant to be permanent and which are meant to keep personnel, living people in them for periods of time, they have to have ventilation. You can't stay in a, you know, in a tunnel without asphyxiating if you don't have ventilation. You can run through one or crawl through one for a couple of minutes, but if you're going to stay there overnight or whatever,
you're going to hold hostages.
All of that.
20 months.
Or even to store ammunition and explosives, you have to have a stable environment. That requires fairly complex ventilation. It obviously requires electricity, power to keep all that going. So they take that power from above ground. And so the hotels basically powering a network of attack tunnels underneath it. In 2014, there were rockets being launched from a couple of, like 100 meters away from the hotel. And the IDF eventually struck the rocket launching sites. And they even posted at the time that Hamas is using the Al-Mashdal Hotel as cover, because the satellite image, you can see that on the roof of the hotel, there's a giant UN painted on top of it, like to deter the Israeli Air Force from striking the target.
Now, I just want to understand from Bashar Masri's point of view, do we know that he was aware of Hamas using his hotels, his industrial area, as basically as a base for their terror attacks?
He says he had no idea. He's a VIP who stayed in the presidential suite or the royal suite and would never hear tunneling going on, whatever. The bottom line is the complaint alleges, and we provide concretized proof of it, that in May 2022, as an example, he personally attended the ceremony at the Gaza Industrial Estate, signing an agreement with Hamas government to improve and redevelop the Gaza Industrial Estate. And the Hamas minister, who I'm pleased to say is no longer with us, was there standing next to Masri at this signing. And because at the time in May of 2022, 22, they felt safe and comfortable with this. They actually posted the photographs and the announcement on their own website.
Right. Although, again, he might say this was the government in power. I was working with the political bureau of Hamas. I had no idea that there are terror tunnels being built underneath my hotels, industrial area. I didn't know that we're siphoning off electricity.
Sure. I'm sure that's what they would say. But first of all, just to be clear, entering into a commercial agreement with Hamas is a crime under U.S. law. There's no, like, it was the government of Hamas exception. Hamas is a unitary entity committed to mass murder. Granted, from their perspective, it's justified mass murder, but that doesn't change the equation from a legal standpoint. The second thing to say is that, you know, even in the Gaza industrial estate, in 2018, Israel discovered an attack tunnel that ran from the Gaza industrial estate across the border, past the Karni crossing to Nahal Oz, or not quite to the kibbutz, but close to it, and demolished the part on the Israeli side of the border. And then in 2021, because of that pre-existing attack tunnel infrastructure, the IDF hit some of that in the 2021 operations. So even, and of course, this was true with damage to the hotels in 2014 and so forth, how many times do your properties have to be hit by the IDF for rocket launching or tunnel infrastructure before you say, you know what, I think these properties are a problem and they're being used by, you know, very bad people and we should just get out of this business. On the contrary, that 2002 signing ceremony with Hamas was to repair damage and to improve the facilities because the IDF had damaged the prior facilities. Wow. So this idea that, you know, to paraphrase Casablanca, they're shocked to learn there's gambling going on, is just not plausible given all of the circumstances, given the number of times that there was damage previously inflicted for this very reason. So beyond that, you look at how Patico, which is Mastri's company, described what happened to the hotels, which got demolished essentially at the end of 2023, or the destruction of the Gaza industrial estate. They don't say, oh, you know, it's terrible what war does, and, you know, we feel badly for our employees or what have you. Their press release says, you know, destroyed by Israeli aggression, as if the Israelis just decided, right, we don't like five-star hotels, or we don't want further, you know, light industry in Gaza, as if it's all out of spite rather than because of the very tunnels they know perfectly well were running underneath their properties.
And who are the plaintiffs in this case?
So the plaintiffs in this case are the families of American citizens or themselves American citizens who were killed or injured or taken hostage as a result of October 7th, as well as the families of American citizens who served in the IDF and were killed or injured subsequent to October 7th in Gaza.
So, and two names that jump out when I saw the list of plaintiffs. One is the parents of Hersh Goldberg Polan, who was executed, taken hostage by Hamas and executed in captivity. And the other one, which I didn't know the name of, Eyal Waldman, who was a former business partner of Bashar Masri, and whose daughter was murdered in the Nova Festival, which I find fascinating. And, you know, maybe the last piece of shocking detail in this case is that Mr. Masri was, up until recently, and members of the Dean's Committee at Harvard Kennedy School. So, which brings me to the last question. How does this all come to play on American campuses? The, you know, from your knowledge, the Iranian proxies, the channeling of money, American citizens, you know, working with Hamas?
Wow, that question requires a 3-hour or more episode of your show. But the very short answer is that over the course really of starting in the 1980s, really, is the gradual red-green alliance, the merger of the Islamist organizations led by the Muslim Brotherhood and their ability to work with principally the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, to forge an alliance that would tap into the larger leftist political and social movements in Europe and the United States and Australia elsewhere, but principally in those places. And the real key, historically, I should take a step back and say that, for example, in the 1980s, when Hamas's predecessor, Muslim Brotherhood organization, was operating in Gaza, one of the reasons that the Israeli government did not take action against them is that they didn't attack Israeli forces back in that period. Their main target were other religious Muslims who didn't adhere to the Muslim Brotherhood creed, and principally the PFLP. They would attack and murder and whatever else members of the PFLP, because back then during the Cold War, Soviet Union was still very much around, and the PFLP was sort of the Marxist, Arab nationalist forefront of the Palestinian cause. You know, these are the guys who, you know, were involved in hijackings of airplanes. They were the glamour part of the PLO terrorist apparatus. So the Islamists, the Ikhwan, the Muslim Brotherhood, led by Sheikh Yassin, viewed these Marxist secular competitors as their main competitor for control. So for many years, these two groups were at each other's throats. But as the Islamists became ascendant and as the Soviet Union crumbled, they realized that they could really use each other, because the PFLP was dwindling in power, patronage, and manpower, and the Islamists were swelling. Ever since the Islamic Revolution in Iran, they were in the upswing. The problem is that the Ikhwan, the Brotherhood, if you scratch the surface, are not that appealing to your average left of center person in the West, right? They have a very strict and traditionalist view that most women in the West don't particularly admire. They are extremely violently adverse to the gay and lesbian community.
We're not very Western, let's say.
Yes, they have very traditional, I would say, 13th century views of a variety of topics. The PFLP, on the other hand, had spent all of the 1970s and early 80s with patronage from Moscow, cultivating leftists and liberals in the universities and NGO world, and knew the language of liberation, of progress, of anti-colonialism. They ingested, maybe not in the same spirit, but they knew the code words that gain entry into the academy, which the Muslim Brotherhood had trouble with, because as soon as you ask them a question about, you know, gay rights or feminism or whatever, they'd lose their audience. The PFLP, therefore, was the perfect plus one at the dinner party because they gained them entry and respectability, and they recast not just the Palestinian cause, but also the Islamist cause as one of indigenous people expressing their genuine, authentic culture, as opposed to medieval totalitarians. So a lot of this is about long-standing and hard-fought-for branding. And over time, as other factors in our culture, particularly in the post-Cold War era, lended greater and greater legitimacy to the PFLP's worldview, anti-colonial, anti-racist, all these sort of terms that often mean the opposite of what they claim to mean. The Ikhwan, the Brotherhood, was able to tag along onto it. And now you see, of course, you see it much more up close than I do, how people who think of themselves as progressive, as champions of the underdog and so forth, are standing hand in hand with people who in any other universe would be the absolute diametric opposite of what they think they believe in.
That's incredible. And I really do hope that all of these lawsuits and the many more to come not only bring some justice to the victims, but also bring these issues to light, that more and more people will know about the behind the scenes. So we end every episode with what we call the Here I Am Lightning Round, a series of rapid fire questions. There's no right or wrong answer, just the first thing that comes to mind. Gary Olson, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Well, that's a long list. I would say my deep admiration for British crime dramas.
Any favorite one in particular?
Prime Suspect with Helen Mirren's an old favorite.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
That we're the only people in the world who are both accused of being communists and controlling the international banking system, of being both shiftless and overly nationalistic. We're the original paradox in terms of a universal adapter for all hatreds.
I like that, or I don't like that, but it's a great metaphor. When was the last time you cried?
Well, it happens pretty often in my line of work. I shed a couple of tears this morning when I read that some of the men responsible for killing many of my clients had perished in the recent strikes by Israel.
If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
Well, that's a great question. So many potential answers come to mind. I, of course, would want to speak to Moses just to see, like, how this all turned out was probably quite different than what he imagined. but there are plenty of other examples.
What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
I think my favorite one is probably Passover.
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Well, now it's Simchat Torah.
Yeah. When do you feel safest?
I don't think I ever feel safe.
When do you feel least safe?
It's hard to answer. I've been in some places over the years where to do my work, I've not felt particularly safe. But, you know, I'm always reminded that my clients have been in places and circumstances far, far more serious than anything I've encountered. So anytime I feel a lack of courage, I have to remind myself who I work for.
What gives you hope?
I think, strangely, I'm going to say the state of Israel gives me hope. It's very aggravating much of the time, but it can only be explained as some sort of cosmic miracle. Whether you believe in the Bible or religion in general, it's just a remarkable, inexplicable thing. And anyone, as you know, I'm one of these people. I've been to Israel many times for work and been there over the years, going back to the 1980s. If you know, like, where it started, you know, the internet meme is always how it started, how it's going. And you realize that, you know, 30 years ago, getting in an elevator that worked was a miracle. And so now you see the skyline of Tel Aviv, and I used to visit an office in the Shalom Tower in Tel Aviv, and that was for a long time a landmark because it was the skyscraper of Israel.
It's 20 floors,
right? Yeah. And now it, no one even remarks on it. It's just an afterthought. That's something which is just a remarkable human achievement in spite of all odds and all efforts to extinguish it. So that gives me hope.
Finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
Wow. There's no shortage of causes. One that's close to my heart is the Kobe Mandel Foundation, which was named after Kobe Mandel, a young man who was murdered in 2001 and during the Second Intifada. And the foundation works with the children, primarily the children, but also families of victims of terrorism in Israel who struggle, of course, in the aftermath of that kind of horrific violence. And it's very important for them to be able to talk to and meet with other families who've gone through the same thing, because no matter how much the rest of us empathize with people in those circumstances, we just never fully know what their lives are like and their experiences. So that's a great foundation.
Kobe Mandel Foundation. Well, this has been a very eye-opening conversation. I wish you all the best in all the lawsuits and the ones to come. And I'm pleased to say, here I am with Gary Olson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."